The Hard Yards, brought to you by Sports Joe.
It's gone to the short side. Oh, it's gone to the short side. It's gone to the try line. And Murray.
I don't think we met before, but I'm the referee on this field, not you.
Hi, Rob. Zeeb here. Just want to discuss the captaincy next.
He's calling.
When Ringrose comes through. Oh. That is brilliant from Ringrose. Ringrose is going here. What a score.
Welcome to the Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady and I am excited about today's show. I'm joined in studio by the trusty duo of Pat McCary. Pat?
Good morning, how are you?
Very well. And Kevin McLaughlin?
Morning, Andrew.
You're looking very bright.
Yeah, I'm doing my best to copy you. I'm just gutted that you're wearing the most dour grey jumper ever on a Monday morning.
I am dressed
Steel
in
uniform.
Yeah, this is Monday morning
Steel
material
uniform,
right here.
Exactly, yeah.
Pale blue shirt, dark grey jumper. All I need is a little tie sort of down to about there. Yeah. We're a little less giddy than the last time you were in. Six Nations show was properly giddy.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I think we were all just on a high after the Six Nations, but loads to be excited about still in Irish rugby.
Yeah, it's good.
Place. Loads like exciting games at the weekend and good rugby and Leinster producing some more young fellas for us to watch and enjoy.
The production line continues.
Yeah, you were at the RDS?
I was. Yeah, we'll come back to that. Yeah, I was dry, unlike a lot of people.
You were happy with the stewards. I saw you were commending them over Twitter. The Leinster Stewart.
Yeah, so it was a half full stadium. Like, there was never going to be a full crowd for the home match against Zebre. But after, I'd say, 10 minutes, the rain was biblical. I mean, it was just driving down. And you know, when the rain drives down so hard, you see people scatter like ants from the stand. And I was with a friend in the grandstand just below the press box, actually, and I was talking to him saying they need to let those people in. Like, there's no point people getting soaked, you know. Mm. But I suppose, in theory, all the season ticket holders could arrive. But at halftime,
I thought you would have been the opposite, up in the grandstand, sweating with an extra pair of gloves on, looking down at them saying, don't let the commoners in, leave me up here in my grandstand. And I'm delighted here at my three seats either side of me. Like.
No, my
Sunday papers.
My butler takes care of all that hassle for me. Anyway, we will have a couple of very big, both literally and figuratively, people coming in later on. We're speaking with All Black legend Brad Thorne about coaching with the Reds, playing with Leinster, playing with Kev, more importantly.
The big one.
and generally about being a very admired man in the game. And then we are talking to Damien Brown, rower-in-chief, about his solo row across the Atlantic and other adventuring and his rugby. So, that's coming up. Also, we've had some great shows recently. You might make sure to check out. We caught up with Conrad Smith in episode 56, and he was in great form. Definitely worth a listen, and here's a quick few seconds. So where did the snakey nickname come from?
It's a cricket coach that gave it to be honest. Everyone has their own opinions, which aren't very flattering. I tell you, when I first met my wife, it wasn't a nickname that I wanted to bandy around. It was a cricket coach who I showed a lot of energy in the field and was stopping the ball a lot, and he called me looked like a snake in the outfield. So, but yeah, it's stuck ever since.
Right, so we're into the very meaty end of the Pro 14 season. First season with conferences. As you said, Kev, there's a couple of good results now all around. It started on Friday night. We probably won't mention Connacht yet, producer Al. We'll leave that in Wales. But
they got battered by Ospreys, eh?
They did, yeah. So that's it.
Every week is just Connacht.
I know, yeah.
Serious performance by Ulster, though.
That's it.
The good news.
To get a BP win over in Edinburgh was a phenomenal result and really took a major, major risk away from their season, because right now they're looking very, very good for getting into that Champions Cup playoff.
Amazing how something like that changes, and they would have loved to have got that back on Edinburgh, you know, because they beat them over in up in Kingspan, Ravenhill, and just great to see kind of the big boys stepping up for him as well. Henderson got that try at the end, but Stockdale with two try assists, and normally you could tell he was drawing people to him because he's a danger
paying
man.
Paying attention to your fantasy rugby team, aren't
you? Oh God, that's probably if I'm picking up minus points at this stage, I think I like one of those people who do fantasy, we kind of give it socks for 8 or 9 weeks, and then I probably still have, you know, all the Six Nations lads are probably still left in there. So I'll log in. I'll log in during the show and let everybody know how I'm getting on. But great to see them. And yeah, because Edinburgh was the big game for them. They had to win. But it is amazing that you're just kind of like, this is the Ulster that, you know, Ulster can do this, but at least they've pulled it off, and hopefully they kind of can finish the season on a high, because as you were pointing out, their run-in isn't anywhere near easy at all.
I know some of the provinces take exception to the RFU rules of, you know, not letting foreign players harbour those key positions, but you've got to look at the Ruan Pienaar decision now, using hindsight. Yeah. And where John Cooney might be if Ruan Pienaar was still in Ulster. Mm. We've now got four provinces and four top-class Irish scrum halves. And you compare that to our English and French counterparts, where the majority of the top-class halfbacks are foreigners in the top teams. It's just an incredible advantage for us to have. And it's painful for the provinces at the time, but the RFU are doing a good job of it.
Cooney was man of the match the weekend there as well.
He was man of the match. He's been their best player all season, hands down. He plays kicks for them. He scores every second game. He makes breaks every single game. He's really composed. He's played at 10 for them.
Yeah.
He's been absolutely exceptional for them all season. And it would not have happened if Ruan Pienaar had stayed. And, you know, that was the thing. Ulster were absolutely going mental about at the end of the season, that we'll never replace them. And he's come in and stepped up. He's been the least of their... Scrum half's been the least of their problems, unfortunately, this season. Mm. But... no, I was delighted to see them get a good win at the weekend. Like you say, Connacht aside, a good weekend for the Irish provinces.
Hmm. So yeah, moved on to, so it's Leinster, Zebre, apart from the weather. Zebre arrived bare bones. They had five front rows on the bench. Have you ever seen that?
I've never seen that.
So they named two extra props because they had no extra locks and back rows ready to go. I mean, that's when you think of, like, Leinster have named their young Mullins their 53rd player that they've used this season.
Well, that's it. Like, the way the modern game is going, you need a squad of 50, particularly if you're playing in two competitions. So Leinster and Munster and those guys. Like, when I came into Leinster first, we had an academy of about 8 or 9 guys. The academy now in Leinster is about 21, 22 players.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the sub-academy then, they can use those guys for the A games. Then the academy guys are coming to the academy expecting to play for the senior team. When I was in the academy, you didn't have a hope playing for the seniors because you were using maybe 35 players in the season. The game's, it's pretty brutal now, and I think because Leinster have 19, 20 players in national camp at any one time, they just have to dive quite deep. But the same with the Italian teams. There's only two teams that make up the national team, so they lose a lot of players and they have a lot of knocks from the Six Nations, I'd imagine. And it's really, really tough. It's a tough position for Conor O'Shea, looking at that Michael Bradley.
In the first half, was a funny game. Leinster were having trouble getting out of second gear. You could see that, okay, the pack aside, there was just a few things that were a little disjointed. But you saw Healy and Furlong, Tracy's an Irish international. You had Devon Toner captaining the side for the first time. You had competent players there like Kearney. You had Dan Levy playing as well. Max Deegan had a stormer man of the match. But that's a decent pack.
Yeah.
And Zebre got two scrum penalties before all the subs came. Now, when the subs came, that changed. But this was a game where Zebre made some really weird decisions in the first half as well, like going for the posts when they were 17, I think it was 17-3 down. You're sort of going, you could pop that in the corner or, you know, try. But it was Leinster saw what they got what they wanted, which was players like Deegan coming to the fore and playing really well. Which,
because we heard that there was a bit of a setback there for Rhys Ruddock and Sean O'Brien. So you have someone like Max Deegan, who made his European debut, and I know it was only a minute or two, but he might be needed, like, you know, in this semi final. Like, so if he's getting a bit of confidence for himself and playing amongst the other bigger lads, and kind of they're all patting him on the back, then it might come in handy because he might be needed off the bench for that semi final. So that's good to see. And
he's been watching a bit of Conor Murray, it seems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think maybe Andy, you might probably technically describe it all, but it was the exact same thing over the ball was out of a ruck. He's looking at the referee, giving him a nod. I'm going for this. This ball is in play.
Yeah.
Went, stole it from almost around his legs and dashed off and got himself, I think, 10 or 15 metre run for a try. So just great awareness again. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this now all of a sudden in the next couple of months because guys are alert to this now.
Shows a level of maturity for him. But just going back to the likes of Max Deegan and Josh Murphy, it's been, they've got a lot of experience over the season, probably more than they would have expected coming in due to injuries to the likes of Reese and Shawnee and a couple of others, and Jamie retiring, obviously. But you go back to the Scarlets away game a few weeks ago, in the pissing rain. It was on a Friday night. It was during the Six Nations. It was one where Shawnee got a dunt in the shoulder. Mm. And the two guys, they had a tough night in the office. I think The Scarlets are a wily team. They're hard to play against, particularly in Wales. And I think that would have been a great learning experience for them. It's very different to Zebra at home. And I think being able to cut their teeth in a couple of tough games like that means that when they do potentially get a chance, guys like Josh and Max, in a semi-final of Europe, it's really important that you've played some of those tougher games as well. Mm. So I'm glad to see Leo has allowed, well, he's been forced to essentially give them opportunities in those bigger games as well, and in those tougher games, because it's just a completely different animal.
Yeah, and we got South African series. Cardiff and Munster are both down there. Different travelling experiences, Cardiff, it seems. Right. So before we get to Munster, if anyone didn't see this, we were getting blow-by-blow updates on a Cardiff travel saga. It was like Connacht a few years back getting back from their mission to Moscow. It was 55 hours.
Yeah, 55 hours, and three lads went ahead of the team. The other guys couldn't get on the flight, and then bags were getting lost when they got there.
Bags didn't arrive when they got there. They were delayed getting out of Heathrow, then they were delayed getting out of Johannesburg to get to Bloemfontein. It would have been faster for them to just jump in rental cars and drive to Bloemfontein.
Give Damien Brown a shout and see if they can head down with him.
Then they almost won.
Penalty try.
But well done, Cardiff. I can't tell you what, they could have a very tough game this week, because I'd say there's a lot of mental energy used there. But Munster, CJ Sanders returned to George. Well done, CJ.
Yeah, I was. That was another game that looked like it was going to be tough for them at the start as well, because Kings, I think, went into a 17-3 or 17-5 lead or something like that, and then Munster just kind of came back and blew them away. And then the highlight for that game, Stander made some brilliant carries, was that Rory Scannell offload for Goggins' try. Yeah,
Jesus, you could watch that again and again and again, which I did.
Yeah, it's worth people. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, just checking it out there. I think Pro 14 have the highlights up on YouTube, so worth having a look at that, because it's. You almost miss it first time. You only catch it on the slow-mo, just exactly what he did.
It gets better every time. It's brilliant, and to do it at such pace.
Overall, do we think the South Africa experiment has been a success? What are people's opinions on that?
People love the Cheetahs. It's almost like they're like a Scarlets version.
Whatever gets the Cheetahs playing in our league, great, I'm up for it. And the Kings, they'll get better.
You hope they will. At the moment, other leagues look at us and they say, right, produce some top quality teams, four or five top quality teams, and then you've got, three or four really poor teams every season that can compete in Europe. And you have, proponents of the English and the French league saying there's no really weak teams in our leagues. Every single week is a tough game. You don't have a Zebra at home where there's five props on the bench or whatever it was, I would just hate for the Kings to turn into a team like that where people just know they're going to be the whipping boy every week. I'd love if they turn into a strong franchise. I think Saru are committed to backing them. I think they're in a really important like political area in South Africa as well. Where they actually really want to get in behind them, get some like a couple of Springboks playing there. But at the moment, I agree with you, the Cheetah story is great. They're going to be in the playoffs, which is ideal, and I think that's enough of a positive for this year to justify the decision to bring the South African teams in.
But they're losing players.
Well, that's it. The danger is going to be a shop window as well.
Well, that's it. But if they can strike the balance, right? So if you've got players, Southern Hemisphere players, South African players going, well, actually, this is a big shop window for us to get a move, great. As long as the Cheetahs and Kings can actually hang on to them for long enough that they're useful. But, staying for half a season isn't good for anyone.
No, it's not. But that's always going to be the challenge for South African teams. You're getting, 14 rand for your Euro. It's just so tempting. It really is so tempting for them. It's very difficult, and it's... But they have such a conveyor belt of talent in South Africa, so I just really hope they can put together two. They have a strong franchise.
The player numbers should mean that that whatever happens, there should be two competitive teams.
Yeah, and considering the Kings lost half their squad just before the start of the Pro 14 season.
It was insane. They had players in on loan and they were grabbing people off the street.
Considering that, they actually haven't done badly. It could have been a lot worse, So
let's look at here's how the playoffs would look if the season ended today. But there's two rounds and a couple of extra little games to go, because we lost some games earlier in the season.
Ulster have one, don't they?
So two full rounds left. Right now, it would be the top team in each conference going straight through to the semis, okay? And that would be Glasgow from Conference A and Leinster from Conference B. Right?
Glasgow qualified back in October, didn't they?
For the playoffs, yeah.
And they have a game in hand.
Oh, yeah.
And that could be important in a couple of ways. So they are at home, they would be at home to Munster or Edinburgh. So they switch. We were talking about this beforehand, just to make sure we got it right. And the other quarter final, as they're calling them, would be Scarlets and Cheetahs. Jesus, get to that game.
Yeah, it'd be pretty about
that. That would be an amazing game. But they're not locked down yet. Okay, so for the next couple of weeks, you've got some big games here. Glasgow could impact a lot of Irish hopes because they play Connacht and then Ulster over the next couple of weeks. But by the time if they beat Connacht, they'll be through. They'll have guaranteed their top seed.
So then they can.
So they might travel to Kingspan going, actually, we don't care. We'll name 15 props. You know, it'll be fine. Leinster need any sort of a, I think, pretty much any sort of a point. 2 points, I think, from their next game, and they're guaranteed through against Treviso. I think I'm right in saying that.
They should be able to manage that.
Yeah. Munster need Glasgow to slip up.
Leinster need, 5 points to finish top or 6 points for the next 2 games?
No, fewer. Because there's only 2 games left and they are four points ahead. Oh, yeah, you're right. My maths are wrong. Yeah, they need a couple
then
more.
They need one away to
ignore my previous thing about 2 points.
Well, they'll probably beat Treviso and blow all that out of the water.
But the way the table sits today is I would guess the way it'll actually finish. The top three on both sides. I would guess it'll actually finish like that, so they're going to be cracking playoff games actually.
Yeah,
and then shaping up really nicely.
So then before we get into the Champions Cup stuff, right, well done Bristol have got promoted. A few Irish there, so Jason Harris-Wright, Ian Madigan, Jack O'Connell, Mark Tainton, and more coming.
Johnny Harris-Wright, Jason's brother, is the S&C coach. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So the two brothers are in there. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
No, so well done. And now might be the time that Saracens have crashed out and there's no... did you read the Gerard Maher piece in The Guardian?
Kind of woe is us.
Let's change the rules again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're joking.
He's doing... I was actually taking the piss last week on Twitter saying, enjoy this, lads, before they change the rules again. And Gerard is obviously talking to people in the game in the Premiership. And here's the quote from his piece. There is a feeling among English clubs that the Champions Cup has lost its aura. Yeah. Okay. So this is all coming back to let's ring fence the Premiership. Bristol are up, which is the main thing. Lots of money there. Buy out London Irish, just pass around.
Oh, and get rid of relegation.
Get rid of relegation, and then over a couple of seasons, have a controlled expansion. So this isn't promotion, this is expansion. Different concept.
So have franchise model, basically.
Yeah. So then, let's say you get to 14 teams, well then you're into the player welfare question. Yeah. Oh, there's now too many games. What's their answer? The answer floated in this from certain sources would be, well, let's reduce the number of games you play in Europe. Do you know what's really good to reduce the number of games? Don't qualify for the semi-finals. So good job. Yeah. Well done. But yeah, it's same again. Let's change the rules.
Jesus.
I saw the Robert Kitson's one as well about having a British-Irish Super League as well. Now, that would bring in a rake load of money, wouldn't it? But I don't think either side will ever admit to...
Would it though?
I'd say so, yeah. You build up, it wouldn't happen.
So we'd have to turn our backs on our Celtic brothers then?
The Celtic brothers are allowed in as well. We'd have to just ditch the South Africans.
So the Africans and the Italians and the French can all.
Yeah.
So you'd have, so you'd have three conferences or two conferences?
I think it was two leagues, tier one, tier two. Connacht bumped down to tier two. But this is almost two divisions. The likes of Saracens, Leicester, Leinster, Munster. It would be one of the. It's almost
never
like having a European Super League.
It's never going to happen.
That's not going to work. I suppose just to go back to your point, Kev, about the mid tier. There's no easy games. Do we think that the call it meritocratic qualification has improved? Not the top teams, right? Your Leinster, your Munster, Scarlets, Glasgow—they're good, but that tier below. Cardiff
have some name for
exactly
absolutely
that seems to pardon them
100%. I think the quality of the league's gone up immeasurably since that came in because you used to get to the last 6 weeks of league and the majority of teams had nothing to play for. You'd have Cardiff coming into town to Dublin for 2 nights on a jolly because they had nothing to play for, and why would they think any other way? They're like, okay, we're going to finish mid-table regardless.
What's the point?
What's the point in really properly going after this?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's up to the league. The league has to create incentives for teams. Yeah. And there has to be, like you say, a proper meritocracy. Like.
No, I'm completely on board with it. I think it has improved Pro 14. And sorry, everyone else, but I think it's improved it across the board. And hopefully we see that filtering into the international sides as well, as players are playing tough games.
Mm.
That improves people.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Sports Joe.
Now, you're welcome back to the Hard Yards, and I'm delighted to be joined by Brad Thorne. Brad, how are you?
I'm very good, guys. Thanks for having me.
It takes three of us to interview the big man.
It's going to be interesting. See how you guys go, eh?
All right. There you go. Challenge accepted. Right. World Cup, Heineken Cup, Super Rugby title, state of origin. You've had a few things under your belt at this stage. But you were a rugby league man when you were a youngster. How did that happen?
That happened because even though I was born in New Zealand, I lived there till I was 9 years of age. My family, like a lot of Kiwi families, looked for better opportunities and moved to Australia. And when I moved to Australia, I moved to Queensland, Brisbane, and the only game I knew, being a Kiwi lad, was rugby, and I loved rugby and I loved the All Blacks. But when I came to Brisbane, at school, they played rugby league, and my mates loved league, and so they got me to come down after a couple of years, come down and play some club league with them, and it was very similar to rugby. Basically, I got to run hard at people and smash people, so I was happy. And as I grew as a teenager, and I guess I started to excel and had a league career, so picked up by the Brisbane Broncos in my final year of high school as a 17-year-old, and then I went from there.
Yeah, Brad, I had someone was asking me when they knew you were coming on the show, they wanted me to ask you what it was like playing with you know, some of those top rugby league players at the time, because you're in such a good team, the likes of someone like Gordon Tallis. What was it like playing with those type of guys in that era?
It was a great era in the 1990s. I started playing first grade as a 19-year-old in 1994. And Gordon Tallis, we were second row partners. I think we played three grand finals together, played Origin together, played Test. So he's still a friend to this day. But Gordon Tallis, if you know much about him over there in Ireland, he could be a feisty character. We used to call him the kettle. So when a kettle, it boils and it whistles, but then it's flat after that. So he'd fire up. Yeah, he would fire up and he might have a dust up or something, but then he'd be spent. You wouldn't see him for the rest of the game. So I play with guys like Alan Langer, probably the best player I played with in both codes. It's hard to obviously say that with all the different positions, but just as much as how he impacted the game, he pretty much won games for us. Guys like Steve Renouf, Glenn Lazarus, one of the best front rowers in the league. Played against guys like Mel Meninga, Laurie Daly. So many great players. It's a tough game, league. It's a real courage game, especially back in that era. You could get bashed in the tackle, you could get bashed in a fight. It was, things have changed in both codes these days. It was a lot more feisty.
Tourney, Kev here. But despite, or obviously winning the Heineken Cup final with Leinster in 2012 with us was the obvious highlight. But despite that, or outside of that, what was the highlight of your career? Because obviously you won a lot of different competitions over a long career. So if you were to pick a highlight outside of that glorious day in Twickenham, what would it be?
Ha ha ha! Yeah, I think it's well known how much I love my time there at Leinster. And that final was just epic. Just the carnival atmosphere of the Heineken Cup. To be with that special group, And the thing that I thought where it got different after that was we had these teams like Toulon with pretty much a World 15 type thing. It was actually mainly Irishmen with a few, you know, you had a few guys in. I was one of them. But it was actually still a proper club team, you know. But yeah, obviously the World Cup, massive. I wouldn't say I enjoyed the World Cup, but it's just something I had to get done. Been 24 years since we'd won it. We'd been always been a great team, the All Blacks, but we weren't winning when it mattered in the World Cups. We've been failing, and as the most senior guy there, as a 36-year-old, I felt a lot of pressure, and I put a lot of pressure on myself to perform, and it was great, you know, to get that result. The French brought everything as they can do when they want to, and I had so much respect for them, the way they fronted. And but yeah, I can get on with my life in peace that we won that. And you saw what sort of flowed after that, this last 4 to 6 years. Sort of like the tackles came off, and you know, they've done really well. The league grand finals are massive because Super Rugby sort of goes for 6 months, but league is I remember starting training in October 1 year and finishing pretty much late September the next, so it's almost like 11 month journey. So when you do that, you play, it's a war of attrition. You play 26 rounds plus Origin plus Test. There's no breaks in between. To hold up a grand, you know, the trophy at the end of a league season with you guys for the Broncos, they were just great times as well. So yeah.
And like one of the things you brought to us in Leinster, you're only with us for kind of 3 or 4 months, but was training with a smile on your face and this attitude of like, it's enjoyable working hard. We know that we're outworking the opposition. They're not doing these extras. And you had an impact on our culture while you were there, even though you're only there 3 or 4 months. Like, people still talked about you the following season, the season after that, and what you'd brought. Like, I remember days when we were outside and it was pissing rain. And we stay around for an extra 20 minutes of scrums, and you were scrummaging with a smile on your face, and you could tell you wanted to scrummage more. You're like, give me more, we're going to keep going at it here. And you brought this energy to every session. How do you find now that you're in a coaching role, how are you adapting that, and how are you getting the guys to enjoy their work? Because you used to talk about enjoying your work every day, and how do you bring that kind of culture into the Reds now?
I guess it's different when you're coaching. For me, as a 4-year-old, I can actually remember saying to my dad, watching my brother play as an under six, let me play, Dad. I wanted to play. I was just itching. And Dad said, you got to wait 2 years till you're under six, then I'll let you play. Now I'm about 2 years, you know, past my career. I'm 43. You know, I last played professionally as a 41-year-old. I'm sitting here thinking, let me play. You know what I mean? It was so easy for me. I love to play. I love contact. I love, number one, camaraderie. And I love physicality. I love competition. I love the challenge. So for me, training in the gym with a smile on my face, but why? Because I'm getting better. Because I live to train, I live to play. I love it. So thank God for those gifts, you know. With coaching it, I've helped coach the gym here. I still do coach a little bit of gym here, even though I'm the head coach. It's just a mindset, a positive mindset. And I think you can, you know, I guess part of coaching is you have the detail of what you're doing, you know, the process, all this sort of stuff, but you also have a presence of, you know, the good coaches. They get your attention, they inspire you, they bring you along. So I like to think, you know, there's a presence there when I talk to the boys, and I guess it's only early days, but I brought through a lot of my young guys, all of my 20s, and I'm looking at, I bring guys in who are interested in striving for excellence. So my enemy is mediocrity. What I'm about is is excellence. That's what we strive for. You never actually attain it, which is the best part, because you just got this lifelong, you know, thing of trying to attain it, you know. So I get guys in who I feel like their mindset is that way inclined, and I also try and coach with a presence that encourages that.
Brad, you've said that, you know, your enemy is mediocrity, and you've set huge standards throughout your career. But if you think back to, let's say, 2001, where you're going from the top of the game in rugby league to essentially learning how to play rugby union, like you said, you weren't a force in the line-outs because you didn't really know what was going on. How hard was that to take that, I suppose, take that dive?
Brutal. It was brutal. So I've always said, if I knew what I was getting into, I probably wouldn't have done it. So sometimes you don't need to know what you're getting into. You know, it's good that I didn't know, because I had a crack, and I was born in New Zealand. Always meant a lot to me. My father, he died at 19, but he talked about when the game, the rumours of it going professional. He said, once you've had a crack at league, maybe you could go back, and if the game goes professional, maybe you could go back and take that challenge on. So, yeah, there's a lot about me going back there. It wasn't just me. It was the connection with my father. So I went back, and like he said, I struggled. A 16-year-old could have told me more about union. It was humbling. It was frustrating. You know, many times, because I, when I left league, you're right, I was at the top of my game. I walk in the room or I go out in the park. You know, you're at that place where you can go, right, I'm just going to take this game by the scruff of the neck. You know, and then next minute you're in this other game where you try not to embarrass yourself. You know, I'm going to a breakdown standing dead upright because I don't know about how to get low. I don't know where to put my head. I don't know how to... I feel uncomfortable getting in the air and lineouts. I can't take all the information in my head that you need to know in union, lineout calls, scrum moves. You know, there's all this stuff just thrown at you. They started me in the position of number eight, probably one of the most hardest positions in the game to learn. I'm more of a natural player, so I probably would have suited six. They had Reuben Thorne, the All Black captain, at six at the Crusaders. When I moved into lock, once they tried me at eight in the NPC, it simplified a lot more for me. I had some time to play some club rugby, and I improved. The big thing, the big challenge when you try something different is it needs to become, at the top level of anything, especially sport, you need to be instinctive. You need to see a situation and you need to act. When you're learning, I look at a situation and I'm thinking for 2 seconds, this is what I'm supposed to do, this or that. But the problem is the moment's already gone. It's moved on. You know what I mean? So I had to work really hard. I would go to a park with my cousin. He would call 300 times different line-out calls. So I just moved to those spots. I would watch stuff. I would, like I said, wake up at 5 a.m. hurting, not wanting to go to training, you know. But I persevered, and I know that, you know, I was humbled, and I know that character was built in me. I was tested, and my faith was massive for me. I relied on God in that time, and I felt like he helped me to grow and in that time. And I look back at that first year coming to rugby, one of the most important years of my life. Would I like to do that again? No. So, yeah, I don't know if that tells you enough about it.
You were saying that just how tough it was, but like, imagine being dropped into a culture like the Crusaders, like where these guys don't go easy on you. Like, what was it like? No one was holding your hand there. Did they give you an equally tough time, or did you find a couple of lads were supportive when you were trying to find your feet?
It's a really good question, because it's easy to forget now there's been a lot of league guys, but I was pretty much the first league to union, and there wasn't a great feeling between league and union back then, if you remember. I don't know if it was like that in Ireland, if you probably didn't, you got soccer and different Gaelic sports in Australia and New Zealand, that it wasn't really nice between them. So I felt like there was different guys, you know, I could sense guys on the team weren't keen on me being there. I had a sort of a pretty reasonable profile coming from league. And, you know, there's guys I would later on, you know, become great mates with. But I remember them being a bit cold towards me when I first came across. And you've got to also remember, you talked about the culture, the Crusaders, but there's an Australian and a New Zealand cultures as well. And Australia, we can be, you know, a bit more banter, a bit more brash or whatever. There was that difference as well. You know, there was the league union difference. Yeah, it was challenging, mate. I remember going back after Super Rugby and I was just down about it. I went back to Brisbane. I remember my brother, obviously I told you my father was my, you know, my best friend and role model. Before he passed away, he wasn't around. My brother said to me, you know, if you're going to be there, mate, you're going to be, you know, I'd met my wife now. But, you know, she's my girlfriend, so I was away from her in New Zealand. So you're going to be away from your lady. You're going to get paid less. You're going to, you know, you're going to have all these challenges. Then at least give it your best shot. Give it a crack. Go back and rip in. And, you know, if it's not to be, so be it. Walk away. But you go back there and for all that it is, rip in. And, I really respect my brother for that chat. Yeah, it's steeled my mind. And sometimes when you're hurting a bit, you know, you need that little bit of a jolt or just, you know, a word. And I remember, I went back and I ripped in. And things started to turn, and you know, all these years later, I'm pretty, I'm pleased that I took that challenge on.
All right, I think Rugby Union's fairly pleased you did as well, Brad. You've given a lot to us over the years. We'll let you go, Brad Thorne. Thank you very much for joining the Hard Yards.
I appreciate your time, man. Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll be chatting with Damien Brown about his recent extreme trek across the Atlantic.
Murder, She Wrote is the perfect thing to watch during the day. You can watch the start, fall off for 40 minutes, come back, see the end, perfect. You know what I mean? You've missed nothing, really. Remember, Raj, Kev in the Killiney used to have to bring two TVs into the room, one for you for Cheltenham. Like every red-blooded male in the country, he'd be watching the horse racing, whereas I'd have a TV for myself for things like Murder, She Wrote and Houses Under the Hammer. Murder, She Wrote is the perfect thing to watch during the day.
Our next guest will be very familiar to Connacht and Leinster fans, and the chances are you'll have heard his name in the news as he completed a solo row across the Atlantic. Damien Brown, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks for having me.
We haven't talked to anybody who's done a solo row across the Atlantic. Why do you do a solo row across the Atlantic,
well,
Damien?
How long have you got? I suppose when I first learned about the row and was James Cracknell and Ben Fogle, they did the crossing in 2005, and I read a book about it, and everything about it appealed to me. The adventure, the challenge, the experience, the extremes, and there and then I knew that I would do it. As negative as the book was and as much hardship they tried to articulate, and it just appealed to me on so many levels. So obviously I was playing rugby at the time, and that was my number one priority, but I knew the minute I got out of rugby I would do that along with a few other challenges that I want to take on. You know, I'm very interested in the physical and the mental side of the body and pushing itself and pushing your limits and all the good stuff that comes with that, the growth and the development and the learnings. So that's why I delve into these things and delve into them pretty deeply with these challenges.
So, okay, so what else have we done? The you went marathon running, but it's not your ordinary marathon.
No, that was my first major challenge once I retired. I did the Marathon des Sables, which is currently started yesterday for the 33rd edition. I did the 31st edition. It's ultra marathon across the Sahara Desert, self-supported, so you carry everything on your own back you need for the 6 days that it lasts. It's six stages, and my year was 257 kilometers, so the equivalent of six marathons in 5.5 days, basically.
This is going to sound... that sounds insane.
It's quite a... What would you say? No, it's quite a kind of cult thing to do in ultra endurance events or ultra running. When it first started, I would say it's pretty insane because it was just one guy, Patrick Bauer, who did it in whatever that is, 33 years ago, on his own, and he had to carry all his own water. At least now, you know, we're given a tent to sleep in, a Berber tent, you know, eight people sleep in it, and you're given water every day at every checkpoint. So it's less insane than what he did. Yeah, it was really enjoyable, believe it or not. It's an incredibly well-run event. Still, Patrick runs it, and this gets about 1,100 or 1,200 participants each year from all around the world. And yeah, amazing organization, amazing setup, really good support, and it's a great accelerated bonding experience. You know, you're put in a tent with seven other. In my case, they keep people per nationality, so Irishmen, and yeah, you just suffer together for 6 days if you can last it out, and you form really strong friendships in that time.
So that's suffering together for, let's say, the guts of a week.
Yeah.
Your next journey was 2 months on your own.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference?
The difference, I suppose, was I didn't think of it I didn't compare the two. You know, they were just things I was always going to do. I never considered doing the row in a team or in a pair because I know teams. I've been in teams all my life. I consider myself a decent team member. I know the dynamics of teams, and I didn't feel I had as much to gain or learn from the team experience or a team ocean row. So it was always going to be a solitary endeavor. It was always going to be, maybe a little bit selfish, but you know, that's what I wanted to get from the experience.
Why do you say selfish?
I suppose I wanted all the kind of learnings and the growth from it for myself. You know, I didn't want to kind of share it with anyone else. And maybe there's a part of me deep down that wanted the adulation for myself as well, perhaps, you know, or the success of it all for myself, you know. Perhaps, you know, I thought about it for a long time. You know, that's 12 years thinking about it from time to time, and you know, there's probably, it's, you know, I'm not sure, but there's probably a part of me that just, you know, had no interest in sharing that with anyone else because it's been mine for 12 years and it's been my goal, and you know, I wanted all that for myself.
So going on a journey of that length and solo, you are the machine. What happened to your body over that time?
So the first time I felt it was starting to break down was around day 25. When I say break down, it's just a case of sitting in that position for so long and the pressure sores that come with that, you know. So basically your undercarriage starts deteriorating first. Pressure sores, salt sores. The salt sores just come from being damp all the time and wet, and it's very hard to get dry. You basically don't have a stitch of clothing or anything that has a dry patch on it after about two weeks.
Can I ask a silly question?
Sure.
What are you wearing?
Basically a pair of lycra shorts, and it depends on the time of day. I'd start in the morning with like a dry top on. It depends on the conditions as well. And then as the day started to get hotter, as the sun came up, you start stripping off. And basically, I think it was around day, I don't know, I'm going to say mid-30s to 40 that I first rode naked.
Should have rode naked. How many days did you do that for?
I didn't enjoy it at all, so it didn't last too long. But I rode naked for about, I'd say, 4 or 5 days.
And was that, what was that experience like? Was that kind of, you know, fun, liberating, weird?
No, it was just uncomfortable. Like, everything was uncomfortable. Yeah. So psychologically it's very difficult because you're going through physical pain. It's like sitting on sandpaper basically for 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day rowing. So if you can imagine, you know, that's painful, and then you're thinking, well, I've got another 1,000 miles to go, I've got another 2 weeks of this. So it's just trying to stay positive when you're going through that discomfort bordering on pain. And it did get to pain, you know, just because the deterioration kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I felt like I'd exhausted all solutions. Like, rowing naked was meant to be a solution. It wasn't. You know, pain meds were meant to be a solution. They didn't do much. Varying up the seating wasn't much of a solution. So I was kind of broken. It was breaking me down further and further and further. And it came to a stage where I contemplated rowing for 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off, because that's as long as I felt I could sit down without being in, you know, extreme pain, kind of. Thankfully, the solution I ended up finding was I brought a second seat. Now, it wasn't very well designed because I didn't use it in my training, but I cut it up into pieces and layered the pieces on top of each other and then cut holes in the seat. It was made of yoga matting, so it was, you know, and then I was able to relieve a little bit of the pressure off the sores. I got in the sea one day, gave myself a good scrub and came out, had a clean water wash, you know, because we desalinate the seawater into clean water, and just scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed the sores. And it gave me a good 10 days leeway until it all came back again towards the end.
So that was a physical challenge mm-hmm. that you went through over this, what was it, 64 days? 63 days. The mental side, go back to, there's a really interesting piece in the New Yorker recently about Antarctica by David Gran, about Henry Woolsey, who tried to walk from one side clean through to the other side unassisted. So even when he stopped at the South Pole, he wasn't allowed to go in or receive any assistance. He had to sleep outside in the same tent and all of this. And he said, he talked about losing direction. And he said, look, he reckons that he lost around 3 miles distance today from snaking around, head permanently bowed to read the compass, just as shuffling skis to look at. Anyway, now I'm back on track, and I'm now happy I can part a straight line even through another day of the white darkness. Mm. Now, you weren't using any navigational aids either in terms of an auto aid.
Yeah.
So did that ever happen to you? You're sort of wondering, where am I now? Am I pointing the right way?
Yeah, I had major technical difficulties on board. The first thing that went wrong was there's a thing called a deck repeater, which is a little screen on the deck that repeats basically the GPS, your GPS bearing, your bearing, your GPS position, your speed, and your heading. That broke on my first capsize, so all of a sudden I was down to just the compass. Now, the problem with the compass was there was a difference between the compass and the GPS of about 30 degrees. So I was constantly second-guessing which is right, you know. So
does that mess with your head?
Yeah, completely. It's an absolute mindfuck. so you're constantly, you know, like I said, second-guessing. And then you just pick one and you just go with it, kind of thing. So
which did you go with?
I went with the compass because it was between my legs, you know. Mm. At the end of the day, I'd have a look at the GPS to see where I was and see, you know, that I was still kind of heading relatively in the right direction. But there was times where I was rowing basically, I was rowing kind of northwest when I should have been going west, or southwest when I should have been going west, because I lost my steering, and the steering, without the steering, was very difficult to keep straight downwind and downwave the minute I'd stop rowing, I'd be turned beam on, which means the boat would go sideways, and then I'd be heading kind of north-northwest or northwest. Now, because the distance is so grand and vast, it's not really that, it's not really a huge difficulty. You kind of, you can row that direction for 10, 20 miles. You're still going west, so you're kind of content enough in that. But it's not ideal if you're trying to get across as fast as possible, obviously.
No, not great.
No.
You've done two challenges. You seem to have a list in your head.
Yeah.
What's the list?
So I would say the row was on the list of about five things. The row was the kind of the major undertaking. And not just the row itself, but the campaign you have to put around it, you know, the fundraising and the charity side of it. I'd like to cycle from, I'd like to cycle the Pan American Highway from the top of Alaska to the bottom of Argentina. I'd like to motorbike the west coast of Africa from Morocco to South Africa as well. And I'd like to do the Seven Summits as well, the highest mountain on each continent.
Okay. Yeah. So, do you cycle?
Sure. Do it's you pretty easy.
Have you a motorbike?
No, I've done lessons, but I haven't got my license yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And mountain climbing? Done?
I've done Kilimanjaro, Mount Blanc, and another Alp called Gran Paradiso. I've done some high altitude stuff in Afghanistan, and yeah, I'd like to, you know, I find mountains really difficult mentally.
Why?
Because of the lack of oxygen. Okay. You know, you're constantly in an oxygen depleted state, so you're constantly out of breath, basically hyperventilating, and it's just about controlling that breath and staying positive and almost staying in a very neutral state of mind, you know. So it's very like, well, you know, from the little bit of meditation I've done, it's really like a form of meditation. You're just trying to tune in to your breathing and be as efficient and use the little bit of oxygen that's in the air as efficiently as possible. So I really struggled the time I did Kilimanjaro, because I did it in the pre-season or the off-season between two rugby seasons, so it was pretty big, like 125 kilos or so. So that's not an ideal weight to go nearly 6,000 metres into the air.
So, okay, we go home after the last game of the season. The lads are going to the pool. Right?
Yeah.
you say, nah, I'm not doing the pool. I'm dragging 125 kgs up a mountain.
Yeah, simply that was it. You know, I have no interest in going to, you know, a resort or anything like that. So, yeah. I had done the a thing called the Lares Trail in Peru, which was my first insight into altitude. It's like an equivalent of the Inca Trail.
Yeah.
You end up in Machu Picchu, and I loved it. You know, I was kind of it was a shock to the system. Like, I'd never experienced altitude, and I had a big heavy backpack, and I had my laptop in my backpack, all sorts of stupid things, you know, at the time, but I didn't know any better. So I got a great reward from that, just coming back to the whole challenge physically and mentally, and, you know, the lack of oxygen in the air. So it was always in my head to go a bit higher, and the obvious one is Killy, you know. So I basically just decided kind of one in the middle of one season that I was going to do in my off season. And like I said, I pushed really hard to get to the summit. My guide was actually kind of advising me to stop, because there's three peaks on Killy. Gilman's Point, Stella Point, and then the top summit. And he was like, oh, I got to Gilman's. He was like, well done. I was like, what you mean? He goes, well done, you know, we go back now. And I was like, I'm not going anywhere. I had to bargain a little bit with him. I said, we'll go to Stella anyway, we'll try Stella, which is another like 150 metres in altitude or so. And I got there, and he was like, okay, now we go back. And I was like, you can see the way Killy is, you can see the summit, it kind of curls around, you can see people up on the summit, you know, it's another probably 200 metres from Stella. And I was like, no, we'll just try. So I pushed really hard, I convinced him, and we pushed really hard and got to the top. But then when I coming down, the altitude sickness hit me hugely, and I nearly became, I was close enough to helpless. Like, I was I never felt so tired in all my life. I'd walk, you know, 5 meters and I'd be bent over like I ran 400 meters flat out. Like, I mean, I was just completely hyperventilating and, yeah, basically helpless. And it took me about 2 hours to kind of get back down to Gilman's. And, you know, that should take no time at all. You know, you should really nearly run down that.
Did you get to that stage at any time in your sea crossing?
No, I never had such a physical, such a physical kind of challenge or mental challenge. The row is really just, it's hardship and it's discomfort and it's just trying to stay positive through those things. And it's time as well, you know, the huge amount of time that you have to stay in your own head and try and not feel sorry for yourself, because it's very, very easy to feel sorry for yourself out there, you know. You nearly wake up feeling sorry for yourself. You have to pull on wet clothes, you have to go out into the dark, there's squalls hitting you. Like, a squall is like this kind of curtain of rain that only, it's like a monsoon curtain of rain, and you see it coming on the horizon, but of course when it's dark in the morning you don't see it and it just hits you. And you know, it doesn't do much for your positive mindset, I can tell you that.
the one thing I wanted to know, Damien, was it's like at the end of this, and you're saying you're in your own head for 63 days, you're pushing yourself through it, all these dark moments, but then you get off this, you're back in society again, and then maybe you're in the airport before you fly home, and here you have TVs around you, people all looking at their phones again, and you're sitting on a plane, there's a movie in front of your face. How strange was that to try and get back to society? And was it weird for the first couple of days and weeks?
It's scary how quickly you adapt again and get back into things and kind of the comforts of it. It only took a couple of days, and I just felt like the role was distant, you know. I was like, and there was so many times on the row I was telling myself, you know, someday you won't have to get up and row, you won't have to put on wet clothes, you won't have to go through this hardship, you won't see just the horizon, you won't see, you know, surrounded by people. And then when you get there, you just flip kind of back into normal routine really quickly. And it was kind of, I don't know, disappointing that, you know, I didn't have such vivid memories of kind of the daily stuff I went through. You know, I remember the big moments out there, of course, and I'll probably never forget them, but just the way everything else became distant really quickly was like kind of shocking and a little bit disappointing. And I kind of wanted to hold on to it, and it was almost, after a week I felt, man, oh, like, what did I just do that? Or, you know, it was very strange.
Right. What do we call you now? We used to call you a rugby player. What do we call you now?
Human. Yeah, I don't like the tag adventurer at all. You know, I don't know if there's any such thing as an adventure. You know, the world is mapped. You know, there's no Livingstons or Shackletons anymore. You know, those lads were adventurers. But I see a lot on social media adventurers, and I'm like, yeah, I don't buy it. Like,
okay,
I like to live an adventurous life. That's the way I like to put it. You know, but I don't have any sort of, if you want to put me in a box, I don't know. I try not to have one, or I just don't have one at the moment.
Okay, then we won't.
Right.
Damien Brown, human. Thank
Perfect.
You. Thank you very much for popping into us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Sports Joe.
You're welcome back to the Hard Yards. We're going to take a look at some of your fan questions. Now, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @thyrugby and use the hashtag #AskThy if you want to get a question in for next week. First one's a cracker. Well done, all things Oval. This is the quality of listener we have. Bravo. Here's the question. If there was one law in rugby you could remove from the game, what would it be? Be it one not properly officiated, one which removing would improve the game, or even for comedic purposes. We've had a chat about this. We've got some suggestions. I'm sure everyone's got good ones. I'll start. Get the ball rolling. I would like to stop. I would like to go back to release the ball when you're tackled.
Oh yeah, yep.
Right. Just release it. We weren't able to hold on to it while the other guy's grabbing it. Just release the ball. That's how we were taught to play.
So you mean the minute you hit the ground and you place it?
When you hit the ball, I'm allowed to just place it,
and
but
then
I'm
let
not.
Go.
But yeah, exactly.
Can't
I'm
keep
not,
your hand on it.
No,
I'll be carnage.
Call it comedy.
So this is comedy rather than
well, actual, you know, fine line between comedy and carnage. Right, next.
Not accepted.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, don't wait. Okay, we're not. I'm crossing this one off. I'm literally doing that. Okay, next.
Slightly controversial one for me, looking across to our rugby league brothers. The way during a game, one of the issues at the moment is the TMO just slows the game down an awful lot. And I think for foul play, the way they do it is they put a player on report.
The white card.
So a player. The referee would be like, please take a look at that, I'm putting you on report or whatever, but the game will keep playing and then they'll get punished after the game. It's slightly controversial because people say, okay, well, the foul play was during this game, so he should get punished and it should have an impact. But I mean, it's an interesting way to keep the game flow going and not spending 5 minutes reviewing video footage of foul play and just let them do it, put them on report and then make the decision after that point. The other one I had was the whole tackle into maul, into flop all over the ball and scrum thing is something Munster and Ireland and Les Kiss like came up with, and was an amazing tactic for Ireland. Like all the teams in Europe seem to be doing it.
Explain
now.
Exactly what you mean by that, step by step. So what you mean?
So where a ball carrier carries into the tackler, and rather than chop him straight to ground or bring him to ground and let him place the ball back or bring him to ground and try and fight for the ball on the ground, it's hold him and try and use your legs to actually hold him up in the air. Guys Ian Henderson.
This is the choke tackle that we all know and love.
The choke
here.
Tackle, and it's kind of evolved now where someone like Henderson is like almost hitting the guy low and driving him up so he can't get to ground. Another guy will come in and smother him. And Johnny Sexton's really good as well. There's a few guys that are masters at it, and they'll get around, hold him up for 2 or 3 seconds while looking at the ref. The ref will call him all, and then they'll flop on the ball.
Okay, so you don't like this?
I think it's something that didn't exist until Les Kiss and whoever else in Ireland kind of came up with it. I think it was pretty smart, but I just think it's actually quite negative from a open play standpoint.
Okay,
I think it slows the game down a bit.
Yeah,
and I think all the teams are trying to do it, and why wouldn't they? But I think it would be an interesting rule change, just to say, I don't know what the rule change would be, but you can't. I mean, it's a difficult one. You can't say that you can't set up a maul, because some teams use it as an attacking ploy as well, to set up a maul off a ruck or whatever. Some of the big French teams use it, but
So we're accepting the on report. We like that suggestion, do we?
Yeah, but you could try it out. The great thing about rugby is
if it's not clear and obvious.
Yeah, if it's not clear and obvious,
then we sort of say, lads, you've got, that's it, on report when we find out.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that's improving about rugby, that sometimes it's like the ref just like, he's getting stuff in his ear, like, I've seen something here. Let them kind of look at the replays and then go back to the ref about it.
Exactly. It's all about continuity, yeah.
Okay, and are we ready to ditch the choke tackle yet? Mainly because, you know, we're good at it here.
Wouldn't be good for Ireland. Yeah. No.
Okay, so I'm being parochial.
Or Leinster, actually.
I'm not accepting that.
Okay.
Okay. Pat?
I have an addition rather than taking anything out of the rule book. I'm thinking the way Barry Hearn has kind of revitalised darts and snooker with the golden ball. So what I was thinking was, you have a player who you designate as that this guy for 5 minutes, he gets double points. So it's like the golden player. So then let's say if it's Stockdale or something like that, get the ball to Stockdale. But I was thinking the only
three people marking him, I just take him out.
I was saying the
how
only
many points does he get for a try? Double points.
I was saying the only negative, and this the only negative I can see from it, is that you might have an increase in like ribs being broken. Guys being targeted for those 5 minutes.
Oh, he'd be absolutely
Alan Wynne Jones would just sit on him for 5 minutes.
Yeah. He'd be milled. That could be interesting.
Interesting, because like the worst thing you could do is force it and be like,
yeah,
you know, someone makes a clean line break and waiting for Stockdale and gets absolutely smashed. Or like it'd be interesting to watch. Yeah.
Especially if you were 9 points down at the end of a game, you know. There you go. We still got the power play in the pocket, guys.
The power play. With your iPad, like, teams would be absolutely killing the golden boy. Honestly, can you imagine?
Oh, that's it. The golden boy, yeah.
God.
All right. So this is one needs development.
Needs, yeah. We'll
but
go
we
work
like
on
how you're
shop.
Thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, love it. Okay, well done, all things oval. Really like those. Right, from Mick Thompson. Tadhg Byrne is going to Munster next year. He's been phenomenal for Scarlets, but with the way Munster play compared to Scarlets, is there a risk he won't be as effective as he has been these past two seasons?
No,
there's not a risk.
No, there's not a risk, okay. Because he's got a lot of facets to his game. I mean, regardless of who he's playing for, he'd keep getting turnovers. He's good in the line out.
Are we sure about that? So this, I was talking to a producer about this off air, because it's something that comes up with player recruitment in team sport, which is that when you lift a player out of one team structure and drop him into a second, his role mightn't be exactly the same. He might react differently to what other players can do. So at Scarlett's, he's been told, and he told us on the show, you're free, just go get the ball.
Yeah,
you see ball, get ball, Tyke, that's your job. Don't worry about anything else. Would Munster and Ireland give him the same freedom? I don't know.
Probably not. He's going to have to adapt his game like you would in any new team, like you would going from Munster to Ireland. But the best players can do that, and he's just got so many facets to his game. He's not just a turnover merchant. He's not just a ball carrier. He's not just great in the line out. Like, he's got a lot of elements. You see him getting like unbelievable turnovers and mauls where he just climbs through the maul, and he's a complete six second row. He really is that. He's probably the best six stroke second row I've seen in a long time. That he can he's equally good in both positions. Actually, really hard. They're very different positions. And I think the Scarlets does suit his second row play, in that they play quite a loose open game for their tight forwards. Like Rob Evans are expected to throw the ball around and offload us. I would say for Munster he's more a six personally. Okay. Because they expect their second rows to be more pick and go in tight, the Billy Holland type player. So I would guess that he'll play six for Munster and he'll be absolutely top class for them.
It's interesting considering O'Mahony's
six. O'Mahony could end up playing seven. I don't know how they're going to fit them all in, but it's for me he's a Munster six. But
The only thing I was thinking about that was just Copeland was a guy who was absolutely brilliant at Cardiff Blues, and then he came back to Munster and he had to adapt his game and didn't quite do as well. And so there's a danger of that, but he's just been, you can't see him going bad. And you'd imagine him going to Australia this summer as well, like, so that will probably get him used to the whole Irish system as well, so he won't just be dropped in at Munster. And although it might kind of reduce his pre-season, I suppose, which might not help, but he'll be
a different player, that's for sure. He'll be different.
So our expectations need to adjust slightly, but the tools that he has, they won't change.
Yeah, because like I think playing in that Scarlets team right now, everyone looks good because they just play great rugby and there's a lot of good footballers. Munster play a different brand and they wear teams down, and like they did against Toulon, they hang in there and they know what to do to win. It's just a different type of game.
Right, very last question. What's the better preparation for the Champions Cup semi-finals? Two home games for Leinster against Italian opposition, or warm weather of training, quote unquote, from Munster in South Africa? This is very quickly, Kev. What would you prefer as a player?
Do you want the short or the long answer?
Short.
I actually think Leinster probably will benefit more, but only because they've been very good this season at just switching on for the big games. Okay. As in, during the Six Nations, they didn't play together in the lead up to that Saracens game. The starting 15 hadn't played together for 2 or 3 months, and they just switched it on.
Yeah.
So they seem to have an ability to cycle players in and out, and then just bang, here's the top 15, let's go and do it. So I actually think Leinster, they can rest guys. I know Johnny Sexton and Sean Cronin and Fergus McFadden spend a week in Dubai on holidays, and you know they'll get more guys on holidays this week, and they'll be really rested and ready to go for the last 5 or 6 games.
Is there anything to be said for the Munster guys being on tour, like as a group,
as a bonding team? Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly not a negative, but personally, in terms of the optimal preparation for a semi-final, I would just probably prefer to be in Leinster's shoes.
Sleep in your own bed.
Even though Conor Murray would look great with a tan, I think, in a semi-final. I've been in South Africa for a couple of weeks, but...
Well, these are the great preparation dilemmas that it's good to have. Okay, make sure to use the hashtag AskTHY if you want to get a question in for next week. Thanks to Pat, to Kev, to Brad and Damien, to Alan McNam for producing, and Shane Dempsey and Fiona Delaney for production. Get back next Monday with a new podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, and every good podcast app to get it straight to your phone. This has been The Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Sports Joe.